Okay, I guess we're about ready to get going. Would you all please rise? Our Father in heaven, we come before you on this Sabbath day to give you thanks for your continual protection and intervention in the lives of each one of us. We thank you for those who have been healed and for the comfort that you've given them. We thank you, Father in heaven, for your continued guidance and overseership and your powerful, unseen hand to use human instruments in spite of their own faults and failings, to your honor and to your glory. We thank you for the work that is going out, for the way you've been blessing it. We ask your continued guidance and blessing over it and over everyone associated in any way with it. We thank you now for the opportunity to get together in this air-conditioned place and to enjoy these 2 hours of fellowship and of worship of you on your holy Sabbath day. We ask you to help us drink in of these portions of the Bible that are thousands of years old, that we can go back and retell and enjoy over and over again the stories of some of the great men with whom you have worked in the past and the lessons that you give us to learn from it. So we ask your blessing and your inspiration for the entire services today in Jesus' name. Amen. Got a few quick announcements. Get them out here where I can see them. First of all, we're going to have to do everything right on time today, and it looks like that won't be difficult with this little flock we have here this afternoon. We'll try to go right on schedule with regard to coming back promptly at 3 o'clock for the beginning of the sermon, and then we have to vacate by no later than 4:30, so we'll only have about a half hour after the final song before we need to be out because there's something else scheduled for the building. The board meeting, for that is the church here, for those who have signed up, the first board meeting for the local Tyler Church. For all who have signed up and any other interested parties, will be held at 1 p.m. sharp right here next Sabbath, 1 hour before services next Sabbath for those on the Tyler Church board. The first leadership training class will be held on Sunday, August 10th, that's 1 week from tomorrow, at 10:30 in the morning at the church offices at 2737 South Broadway. Everyone who has signed up or wishing to meet, please meet with Ted Phillips immediately after services. Then there is a couple of prayer requests and an income report. Mrs. Thelma Carruthers of Baltimore, Maryland, apparently called and asked your prayers. She has a lower back problem. They always identify it as a slipped disc, but that's not technically what it is. Usually it's what we call it, but it could be any number of things. So please remember her. And Mrs. Joan Greats of Cumberland, Maryland, has a tumor, an unidentified tumor. Don't know whether it's benign or malignant, and I know she's very concerned about that. Mrs. Joan Greats of Cumberland, Maryland. Well, I'm going to read you some figures I don't believe. Now, the reason I don't believe them is because faith is the evidence of things not seen, and I've got faith that these are going to be different next week. Otherwise, I would believe these figures. The income for the last week of the month was $9,203. Watch magazine, $115 of that, and tapes, $116.50. And it came to a total, including festival fund, of $10,733.26, which is shortly less than half of what we really needed because of budget. And we were also down a few thousand dollars for the 2 weeks preceding. So we really do need to have a very good first of the month, and I hope you'll all pray about that and bear that in mind. All right, I think we had completed last time the 25th chapter, did we not, in the book of Genesis? I'll put these on so I can see. We're going to read a few rather strange things in a way, especially the birth of Isaac and Esau and how that occurred, and a few perplexing questions that arise as a result of it, of God actually telling people, even prior to their birth, or assigning people, as it were, to a status in life, even prior to their birth. There was a famine in the land beside the first famine in the days of Abraham, and Isaac went unto Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, unto Gerar. The reason there are a lot of people identified as Abimelech is that it was a title, like Herod or like Tsar or Caesar, and Ptolemy and Pharaoh and so on. Abimelech was not his name, but a title of the kingdom. And the Eternal appeared unto him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land which I shall tell you of. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you, and will bless you, and for unto you and unto your seed I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swore unto Abraham thy father." And again, the repeat is made for I don't know how many times now since the beginning of the 12th chapter, where we see God promising national greatness of hundreds of millions of human beings who eventually would become or would be the seed of Abraham. I will make your seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and I will give unto your seed all these countries, and in and through your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Most people, I think, look upon that as only the prediction of Jesus Christ coming through the seed of Abraham. But if you have traveled abroad, especially into some of the Gentile nations at any time, I don't know how many of you might have been to India or to Indochina or even to Central and South America. You could get some kind of a view if you'd even been to a border Mexican city, if you got away from the tourist honky-tonk part and drove out among the Mexican village, the place where the Mexican people actually live. Or if you've ever been to Mexico City and you, instead of staying downtown, you go out into the environs of where millions of people are packed into crates and cardboard and cast off bits of tin and corrugated metal and so on. And if you stop to ask in the span of history of the past several generations, what would the world have been like if there had never been an England and if there had never been a United States of America, if there had never been the peoples of Ephraim and Manasseh? We owe basically our entire heritage, our language, our culture, and especially our concept of law to the British, to the English people. They really, in one sense of the word, from the time of the Dark Ages and then finally the age of the Renaissance and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, I would have to hand it to the British by saying that they were the inventors of what we really call civilization. There was nothing even remotely called civilization as we know it today until in about the 16th century, when the British crown, and even earlier, when the British began warring against the papacy. And really, it is a religious struggle as much as a political struggle, and political freedom only came along hundreds of years after religious freedom was bought at the point of a sword. When King John was finally forced to sign the famous Magna Carta, and there's an awful lot of misconception about that because there were many, many, many different documents that were signed under duress over a long period of time. The Magna Carta simply gets all of the credit in history, but nevertheless, it and many other documents form the basis of law as we know it today, which conveys the dignity of human rights. And the Magna Carta and the succession of documents which were signed, that he was forced to sign, was when the kings and Protestant kings of England turned around and began to give to their subjects some of the same freedoms that they had won from the papacy in Rome. It is not true, by the way, that one of the primary motives for the settlement of the United States of America was religious freedom, because those who came over here imposed their own religions on the original colonies. When you go back and look at the original 13 colonies and then 13 states, they had their various state religions. Doesn't mean there were 13 of them, but it does mean that it was either Anglican, or it might have been Dutch Reformed, it might have been early Presbyterianism, which, by the way, shocking as it may sound, was heavily charismatic. Many of us might not know that the Episcopalians and even Presbyterians of the early New England church would hold incredible, wild, Pentecostal meetings, and I've read a lot of stories in researching some of those early religious activities in the United States. There was one time, for instance, of a woman who allegedly had hair that was reached clear to the back of her knees, and in an absolute violent seizure of some sort, and it's ecstatic Pentecostal thing they were having that night, was snapping her hair back and forth so hard, with her head being jerked back and forth, she could literally hear her hair snapping. How in the world it didn't break her neck, I'll never know. The burning of people who were alleged to be witches happened in Plymouth and Salem, Massachusetts, and areas like that, over 100 years before the United States became a nation. And all you had to do to be labeled as a witch was to get in bad with your neighbors. You could have a few people just sow the seeds of doubt, and they could claim that their cow went dry, or that their chickens didn't lay, or that their crop didn't come in, or that somebody broke out in a mysterious rash. And if you were just a little strange, then you could be labeled as a witch. To a child who had a mental problem and they grew up to be a young teenager, and they weren't quite normal. Well, those people attributed that to satanic forces and to demonism and so on, and a lot of times they would try to ferret out these people they claimed were witches. So gradually, really, basically, we owe religious freedom in the United States not to religious people, but to agnostic and sometimes to atheistic people, politicians such as Thomas Jefferson. I was talking about that on the radio the other day. If we ever get the magazine to press, Mr. Dart has written an article about the separation of church and state, and that issue is being forced by an organization we know to become a very major, and I think it's going to be bigger than ever in the next few years, political issue in the United States. And I think that the great coming battle is going to be in the courts, all the way to the Supreme Court, about the influence of religion and the separation of church and state, and of course even personal human rights. And it will be ironic, as Mr. Dart points out in his article, if the very people who have been predicting and preaching for years that there will be terrible persecutions coming upon the Church of God actually perpetrate or bring about those persecutions by illegal acts, not, ironically enough, by preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God as a witness, not by doing good deeds. You know, when Christ was crucified, he said, "For which deed is it, you know, that you do this to me?" He said, "I was there with you daily, teaching in the temple, and you took me not. Why are you out here with sticks and staves and spears and swords, as if I were some kind of a common crook? What sin, what crime am I guilty of?" Well, when they began to kill an awful lot of so-called, if they were Christian, we don't know, but so-called Christian people during the reign of Nero, it was, as the article points out from one of the Roman historians, because the so-called Christians at the burning of Rome were right out in the street leaping and dancing and applauding and saying, "This is marvelous, burn, baby, burn," kind of an attitude about the burning of Rome, because they had been taught, as their detractors said, to, quote, "hate the human race," end quote. Now, if you go back and you think of the attitude that another church organization has actually come to hold over a period of propaganda and of hate, just a hate campaign in their literature and so on, it begins, first of all, with the hating of sin. It begins with a genuine feeling of repentance, and then it begins with knowledge of having been betrayed and the knowledge of Satan the devil and of his demons. Then you draw this hard, fast line between we, who are in the innermost inside circle, the inner sanctum of truth, we are God's church. Then you just add in this formula years of exclusivism, years of just drumming out into people's minds that we only are the true church of God, and everything and everybody else is a satanic counterfeit. And you begin to learn that everything is pagan. Christmas and Easter, New Year's are pagan. Loaves of white bread and preservatives and dyes and food colors and the FDA are pagan. Every sign and symbol is pagan. A wedding ring is pagan, people would say. Everything we see around us, all literature is trash. All motion pictures are trash, and on and on. So as you label everything except 2 hours in the sanctity of a church meeting is totally pagan, and probably, as some did in the early days, even the cloth in your pants and your socks are pagan. Years ago, on the basis of the idea of not mixing cloth, we knew of students who would come to the college who would take scissors and cut the elastic out of the top of their socks and let them fall down their ankles because rubber was a foreign substance to wool. Literally did it. And we get so careful that there was one minister who actually had all the people pouring their beer down the sink during the days of unleavened bread. He began to think it was the days of unfoamed or unleavened beer. The idea being anything that puffs up is absolutely wrong. Therefore, you're not to breathe for 8 days during the days of unleavened bread. So if you just go one step after another into exclusivity and this continual labeling of everything and anybody who is not a part of your own internal little group is of Satan the devil, and you say there is no in between, you just come right out of the world, you know, pop, presto, change-o, like a baby being born, you draw your first breath, now you're in God's true church. But the idea that God might be working here and there with other people, that God, through His Holy Spirit, might even influence a Methodist. He might actually heal somebody in some healing campaign. or God might actually be working through someone else who is not right here in this exclusive group. No! There's no way you're going to admit that, or your cultic hold over these people is broken. So I see a church group making the same mistake today as some of the early Christians did back during the days of Nero, and got themselves thrown into the lions as a result of deliberately bringing about that kind of a battle. This whole struggle of religious freedom is quite an interesting historical study, and it did not come easily, and it cost an awful lot of human blood. Well, actually, if there had never been these free societies of England and the United States, then a lot of other nations would have been far worse off than they are. So even economically and from so many points of view, look how many nations there are today that enjoy a certain measure of civil rights because of the concept that began with the British people and now the American people. Otherwise, there would be nothing but the same type of despotic dictatorships that rule in such nations as Uruguay and that did for years in Spain. And you would have no personal rights. You're not allowed to just be what you want to be. You can't go where you want to go. You can't own property or get into some different enterprise of your own. And in many nations, that simply is not allowed. So there is a very broad application, I think, to the statement from God that eventually, through the seed of Abraham, every country on the face of the earth would be blessed. We have been the most generous. We have sent tons of money to help bail out starving nations. If you remember back during the 60s, I believe it was, maybe it was even the early 70s, the largest armada that had ever been assembled of seagoing vessels in history, outside of some of the great convoys of World War II, was going back and forth from American ports to Bombay and Calcutta, taking millions of metric tons of wheat to the Indian people, who, because of their stupid religion, they think a cow is God, and they think animals are gods, and so instead of eating them, they worship them. So they're a nation with horrible protein deficiencies and terrible child deformities and malnutrition, starvation, and disease, and we, emptying our bins up in Kansas and the wheat belt of the United States, sent it over there free. We provide the transportation. We just gave the wheat. The sacks had labels of two hands and from the people of the United States of America and so on. And we have done that time after time. Other countries have been blessed because of the kind of people, basically, that the British and the American people are. So it is more than just a reference to Christ. It's also a reference to the kind of people that Abraham's seed would be. Notice verse 5 of Genesis 26, because that is a really very puzzling verse and very difficult for people to answer who want to tell you that the Ten Commandments were never enforced prior to Moses' day. It says it was a great deal more than just the Ten Commandments that was known, because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge. Now, my charge, what was that? Well, that was get you out of the land that you were born in, you've lived in all of your life, to a country that I will show you. Abraham went, he obeyed that charge. My commandments, that's one set of laws. My statutes, that is a written set of laws, and my laws. Now, what are these commandments, statutes, and laws? There is a code that we know of as the commandments. But there are other written laws, and I find it fascinating that God's own word tells us there were laws put down in writing. It's not a statute unless it is a written law. Otherwise, it's a judgment. A judgment is an oral decision based upon a written law, and God would have said, my judgments, or he would have just said, he obeyed my voice, which he did, and my charge, which he did. Those are both oral, just verbal commands. Commandments, statutes, and laws involve the codification of those laws. Now, we know that the various steles, as they are called, or these upright obelisk-like stones were found, not only tablets, but they were used not unlike they used to do. I don't know if they do it now so much in countries in Europe, but you would have certain posted laws at the border. And anciently, at the borders between various races of people, they would set up these waymarks like a pillar, and it would be a huge stone, and on the stone would be inscribed certain basic laws. It would be almost like coming into the border of the United States and seeing that there exists such a thing as income tax and state tax and a national speed limit of 55 And it would also state that you cannot rob or steal or pillage or murder or rape or burn and so on, would tell you what you must not do, what the laws of the land are in respecting other people's rights and other people's property. So the Code of Hammurabi, that is one of the most famous, and some people, having it, of course, perverted backwards, think that Moses got his laws, they call him Moses instead of God's, from the Code of Hammurabi, which in actual truth it was the other way around. It could be that Job lived even prior to the time of Abraham. I don't know that for sure, but it could be one of the most ancient stories of the Bible. There were other written portions of the Bible, I've said as we began this series in Genesis, that I certainly feel that there is strong indication that the 11 documents that make up the first 5 or 6 chapters of the book of Genesis had to be written material. And you get the feeling of an eyewitness account even in the story of Adam and of his progeny, all the various genealogical tables and so on. So when you see, as we saw earlier in the case of Abraham and the little white lie about his wife being his sister, and here is a pagan king who says, "Why is it you've done this to me? I might have committed a great sin." He knew what sin was. He knew it was a sin. If you can imagine this, here's an ancient race of people down in Egypt so many thousands of years ago that it's incalculable, and yet they had the modern concept that to commit adultery with another man's wife was a sin centuries before the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. We used to go through the exercise in a second year Bible class of having the students pick out of the Bible, and we only allowed them Genesis 1 through Exodus 19. They could not use anything from Exodus 20 on through the Bible, except in reference to this previous portion of the Bible. And then even indirectly, we were able to put several scriptures on the board of point by point, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me, you shall not make unto thee any graven images," and so on. Every one of the Ten Commandments, of course, including the fourth one, God rested on the Sabbath day. And then we would go down the line with other laws in addition to the Ten Commandments, and guess what we came up with? Tithing, it's there. It's in the Bible, way before Exodus 20. Clean and unclean meats. People, I don't know why, but as a result of what's happened in the church, a lot of people seem to think that, well, the lid's off, now let's just throw everything out, let's throw out the baby with the bathwater. And as recently as a few weeks ago, someone was commenting, "Well, I'm not quite sure about this business of clean meats, clean and unclean meats." You know, I just asked the question, did God change the texture and the nature of the flesh of animals? Clear back at the time of the flood, God had already revealed to people what was clean to eat and what was not. And the fact that it was a part of and added into a ceremonial code of laws to the Levitical priesthood didn't mean that's when it came into existence. It was nothing. It was not ceremonial. It was a health law. It was a law that had to do with the texture of certain flesh of animal types, of fish and birds that God had created for the purpose of human ingestion, and other types that he had not, which can carry certain diseases and can bring about certain problems in the body. So we know that long prior to the time of Moses, there were commandments, there were written statutes that these sages and patriarchs had written down that very likely had to do with simple human conduct. Maybe a man's animals and his cattle and the digging of a well and perhaps landmarks and laws of inheritance and no doubt laws involving barter or sale, and laws that had to do with honesty and integrity between a man's neighbors and his laws. So that's a very important scripture if you're ever just chatting with someone who is of the opinion that the Ten Commandments were not in force long prior to Moses. Now, Isaac dwelled in Gerar, and the men of the place asked him of his wife, and he said, this is interesting too, he remembered what Dad did. And no doubt they'd sat around 100 campfires and talked about it. And of course, it has been pointed out, I believe, by Mr. Dart earlier, that these were basically swarthy, quite dark people. And I don't think that it necessarily means that Sarah, at age 75, could have been Miss Texas. I do think it meant that she very likely had very long, blonde hair, was very light-skinned, and was strikingly fair, because it's what it says in the Hebrew, of complexion. And these kings, you know, had a whole harem of women. And they would have a wife, and they'd keep her a week or two or three or a month or whatever, and then she'd get retired out back to the eunuch out there in the harem, and he'd get him another wife. And it didn't mean that he wanted to marry Sarah and have her as his only wife all the rest of his life. And I won't go into all of the racist elements of it or anything like that, but apparently he really did want her because she was fair. Well, here was Rebecca, and you get the point in the same verse, because she was fair to look upon. I think it connotes beauty, but it also connotes a very light skin. And it wasn't a taxi cab driver that Mr. Dark was telling us about down there in Egypt or someplace that gave him that statement that they tended to like light-skinned women. So Isaac had probably remembered what his father had done and said, "She is my sister," for he feared to say, "She is my wife," lest, he thought, the men of the place would kill me for Rebekah because she was fair to look upon. And it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting with Rebekah, his wife. Now, apparently, they weren't being too private about it, and sporting doesn't mean anything really horribly evil, but it probably means that there was a preliminary working up to something a little heavy, and they were doing it right out there in public, and old Abimelech was getting a first little glimpse of an X-rated movie. And he got just a little excited about it, and so after whatever, at some length of time, Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, of a surety, she is your wife." Now, if you want a clue as to what it was they were doing, sporting didn't mean playing marbles. You would do that probably with your sister. Whatever it was that was sporting, Isaac was doing with a woman, which led him, Abimelech, to believe she had to be his wife. So, all right. "Behold, of a surety, she is your wife, and how is it you said she is my sister?" And Isaac said unto him, "Because I said, lest I die for her." And Abimelech said, "What is this you have done unto us? One of the people might lightly have lain with thy wife, and you shouldest have brought guiltiness upon us." Look, here is a pagan king who actually thinks that the entire nation might suffer. I just try to think of the world today, even in the White House, today in the United States of America, where you have a peanut farming Baptist from the South. Do you really believe that there is a world leader or the leader of any government on the face of this earth today who is so conscious of the blessings of God or of the possibility of losing those blessings and having a cursing from God instead involving his crops and his weather and his protection, his army, his commerce, his people, having to do with the birth of children, with their physical health and so on, that he would actually feel that a sin right at the top by the leader of that nation or someone right in his own court would bring about God's disfavor and would be so concerned about it that he would do anything he could to avoid that? This is an amazing statement in the Bible that these so-called pagans had a greater concept of God than any world leaders do today, and really of any others except a few of the righteous kings of Israel and Judah have ever had all the way down through history. He had as much a concept of God as Nebuchadnezzar did after he went through a kind of a partial conversion, let's say, after his 7 years insanity, and began to say God was the great God and the King of Kings. And Abimelech said, "You would have brought guiltiness upon us." And Abimelech charged all his people, saying, "He that touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." Another interesting commentary. Here's the statement that they imposed the death penalty for murder and the death penalty for adultery. So he is also showing that those other nations knew of God's laws and that the king backed up those nations' laws, and no doubt they were written. "Then Isaac sowed in that land and received in the same year an hundredfold." That's a pretty good crop, isn't it? Sowed 10 bushels of grain and got himself 100, and the Eternal blessed him. "And the man waxed great and went forward and grew until he became very great. For he had possession of flocks and possession of herds and great store of servants, and the Philistines envied him. For all the wells which his father's servants had digged in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines had stopped them and filled them with earth." Now, there were always conflicts between the ingenious and the enterprising, the hardworking and the intelligent and the skilled who wanted to use the land, who wanted to develop it and to use the resources of the land, and these filthy, nomadic herdsmen who simply wanted to wander about from place to place. They had a very simple life. That simple life has remained unchanged for centuries among some of their same progeny who are in the Middle East today, who survived in their black goatskin tents, who live off goat's milk and cheese and the flesh of goats and so on, and to just live an absolute, filthy, incredibly base, almost Stone Age civilization, and just wandering around from place to place, the Bedouin Arabs. They recognized no borders. The Israeli people let them freely come and go. They wander from Jordan into Israel and set up their black tents. You might go along, and it's almost like the gypsies of the Middle East. In the years when I was a boy, I don't see them around anymore. These gypsy bands would wander around with their colorful wagons and horses and mules, and they would just camp just any place, right alongside a roadway where you would not even think of stopping. Just set up a place there, and there they would be. Nobody would bother them. Everybody always would tell these stories to beware because they're dirty thieves, and they'd set up this little carnival, and they would have shows, and they would do various things like sharpening knives or repairing pots and pans or taking little odd jobs in the community to keep going. And these people were like that. So if you can imagine, people who looked upon a well, one of a priceless thing in that part of the world, as a threat to their way of life, and they come along and kick it full of stones and dirt and stop it up in trying to drive these people out of there and make them quit developing the land. So it said Isaac digged again the wells of water, which they had digged in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them after the death of Abraham, and he called their names after the names by which his father had called them. And Isaac's servants digged in the valley and found there a well of living water. That means an artesian well. So they dug down deep enough and they hit a spring and it was just flowing right out of the ground. And the herdsmen of Gerar did strive with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." And he called the name of the well Esek because they strove with him, which means the well of contention. And that is also fascinating. In the first place, the people who were there didn't want the well. Now, when Isaac's herdsmen come along and they go through the backbreaking work of digging the well and they discover this lovely spring, all of a sudden now these Gentiles wanted the well, and it's our well. It's on our land, we own it, and we want it. So they have a big battle over that in a tug of war of some guy. I'll tell you a little interesting story. South African farmer told me this down in South Africa. He had quite a stand of corn, and right next to him was this black African farmer. And the South African was farming with all the modern techniques and so on. And the black African simply went out and with his old crude hand implements, he would sow a few little rows of corn. Well, his corn was absolutely pitiful. He didn't irrigate. He just stuck the seed in the ground. When it rained, fine. If it didn't, fine, no problem. And he had this small little stand of kind of poor-looking corn. Well, here's this South African farmer with this great, big, verdant, big, beautiful, several-acre patch of corn way over your head, maybe 2 to 3, 4 ears per stalk or something, and this black African farmer just couldn't believe it. Well, he came over there and he began to complain to him and accused him of all sorts of things, accused him of pronouncing a curse over his corn, and that demons and gods and goblins and so on had gotten his corn, accused the South African farmer of doing something, maybe chemically or something, to poison it. Well, the South African farmer said no. He said, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He said, "I'll show you how to raise the corn." So he did, and he put the same fertilizers on it. He came over with his big tractor and equipment, and he plowed up about an acre, and he sowed it for him, and he put the crop in, and he even showed him how to channel some irrigation water over there and to water it. Well, boy, the next year, I mean, this black African had a beautiful stand of corn. And I mean, here came some of his relatives from nearby distant villages. And a whole lot of people started coming in there. Cousins showed up that he didn't even know he had. And the first thing you know, he had a regular community of people in there. And he became very, very unhappy because they ate up all of his corn. And he couldn't keep them in meat and couldn't keep them in food and couldn't keep them in clothing and no place to shelter them. And he just had cousins and uncles and brothers and aunts and everybody just running out his ears. So the next year he went back to the South African farmer. He says, "Please," he says, "I don't want you to help me grow my corn anymore. I want to go back and grow it just the way I always did." And so he did, and gradually all of his cousins and uncles and brothers just kind of filtered back where they came from. He never saw them again. So the South African farmer didn't want to change his lifestyle. He wanted to live just like he always had. He couldn't cope with success because it brought him headaches that he'd never had before. And when you see these herdsmen filling in a well, and then the minute the well is in and successful, coming back and trying to grab it, it gives you a little bit of the attitude of some of these people who don't really know how to improve the land and just don't have the hereditary knack or know-how that God has given the Israelitish people. The herdmen of Gerar strove with Isaac's herdmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek because they strove with him. And they dug another well and strove for that also, and he called the name of it Sitnah. And he removed from thence and dug another well, and for that they strove not. Now they had enough water, apparently. Maybe by now they had too many aunts, uncles, cousins, and brothers. I don't know. And he called the name of it Rehoboth, for he said, now the eternal, and that means broad places, has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land. And it wasn't until there was water enough for everybody to go around and that his own herdsmen had done all the work that these people quit yapping at him and let him alone. And went up from thence to Beersheba. Now, we'll see a little later how Beersheba gets its name. The Eternal appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham your father. Fear not, I am with you, and I will bless you and multiply your seed for my servant Abraham's sake. And he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Eternal and pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. I think that's fascinating. Got four wells at least dug by now. Then Abimelech went to him from Gerar, and Ahuzath, one of his friends, and Phicol, the chief captain of his army, and Isaac said to him, Wherefore do you come unto me, seeing you hate me and have sent me away from you? And they said, We saw certainly that the Eternal was with you, and we said, Let there now be an oath between us, even between us and you, and let us make a covenant with you. Interesting, too, that when you see one nation or one group of people, more or less like, let's say, a group of small villages, I imagine some hundreds of servants and probably some thousands of cattle, sheep, goats, camels, and so on were involved here. And here is one of the first cases of a kind of a peace treaty or a pact between small national leaders, that you will do us no hurt as we have not touched you, and as we have done unto thee nothing but good and have sent thee away in peace, thou art now the blessed of the Eternal. And so, like they always do at such parlays, they had a banquet, and they ate and drank, and they rose up betimes in the morning and sware one to another, and Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. And it came to pass the same day that Isaac's servants came and told them concerning the well which they had digged, and said, We have found water. And he called it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is called Beersheba, or water, Sheba, Sheba's water, unto this day. I haven't really proved this, but in my own thinking, I really believe that the ancient origin of the word beer, the beer that we drink, is Hebrew, that meant water. It's a watery beverage, and it also leads me to believe that the Hebrews must have invented it way back when, because they did have every type of grain and other type of alcoholic beverage known to man. And we can see that even in what God said to them concerning the Feast of Tabernacles, that he talked about various types of alcoholic beverages because it is found naturally. I can't help but wonder that some of these springs, the deep well water and the living spring water, was not used by the Hebrews, that they had discovered how to use wheat and corn and mash and perhaps barley and oats and other grains with that the hops and so on to make beer. And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. And so he married these two Hittites, which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah. Now Esau, of course, was not under the same compunction, so he married these two, and it doesn't say why they were a grief of mind, but you can just figure it out. It came to pass that when Isaac was old, and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his eldest son, and he said unto him, My son, and he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Behold, now I am old, and I don't know when I'm going to die. So I pray you to take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and get me some venison. Make me some savory meat, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee before I die. Here's an aged, elderly old man, and he remembers all of the many times when they've had these marvelous evenings with this great savory roast venison and slivers of it in the juice and so on. And you know, if you've ever had roast venison that was really good and maybe it fed on corn or alfalfa instead of sagebrush and really tasted good, well, that is some of the greatest eating you can imagine. And this reminds me, I'll pass on to you a little story about the Yiddish people in New York City. There was an aged, elderly Yiddish man, and he was about to die. He was a grandfather. And all the family was downstairs, and he was up in the master bedroom and sort of with a death rattle in his throat. And his young grandson, Abe, was there, and he was breathing heavily, and he said, Abe. And Abe says, Yes, grandfather. He says, Abe, I'm about to die. I don't know when I'm going. He said, Oh, Abe, just once more before I go, to be able to touch to mine lips your grandmother's apple strudel, I would love to have it. What is that I smell coming from the kitchen, grandson Abe? It's some grandmother's apple strudel, grandfather. Oy vey, to be able to have a little bit of grandmother's apple strudel before I die. I'm sorry, grandfather, but grandmother says it's for after the funeral. So,
you don't want to waste anything, you know, and I couldn't help it. This poor old guy lying here wanting to taste venison just once before he dies, and just kind of reminded me of old grandfather. Never did get the apple strudel. So he said, make me savory meat, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee before I die. And Rebekah heard when Isaac spoke to Esau, his son, and Esau went out to the field to hunt for venison and bring it. Doesn't mean he went out to a plowed field and found a deer standing around. They're not that dumb, but, you know, it means out into the veldt, into the brush and the woodslands. And Rebekah said unto Jacob, her son, saying, behold, I heard thy father speak unto Esau, my brother, thy brother, saying, bring me venison and make me savory meat that I may eat and bless thee before the eternal, before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to that which I command you. Go now to the flock and get me the two good kids and so on. And I won't read every line of this to hurry along a little bit. But you know the story. So it says in verse 11, Jacob said to Rebekah, behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I'm a smooth man. And when you read the description of the babies we did last time, he came out just as hairy as a little old ape, and apparently had just thick hair. I was on board a ship with a guy like that had to shave all the way down to his neck and heavy hair. One time he got these little monsters that hide out in your pillowcases, and he had them from head to foot. Name was McGeary, and I think he was an undertaker. Hairiest man I ever saw in my life without his shirt on. Absolutely incredible, about that thick. Avon Fund, remember him? I mean, he was something else. There are people like that some of the hairiest people you ever saw, like the Wolfman all over, you know. And anyway, he was that hairy. He was really like a thick mat, just like an ape. So they contrived this. They made the savory meat. Verse 15, Rebekah took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them upon Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids of goats. Now, you know, if you've had a little kid skin, it can be fairly fine, but nevertheless very thick. And it was adequate to completely deceive the older man. Put it on his neck and had these all stitched together, I guess, some way, and actually just covered him up in kid skin so he'd be real hairy, and gave him the savory meat, which he'd prepared. And he came and said, my father, here I am. And he said, well, who are you? His hearing was almost gone, too, I guess. And Jacob said, I'm Esau. I've done according as you bade me. Arise, sit and eat of my venison, which, of course, it wasn't, that thy soul may bless me. And Isaac said to his son, how is it you found it so quickly, my son? He said, because the eternal thy God brought it to me. So they're lying their heads off here, you see, and even saying that God had a part in it. And Isaac said unto Jacob, come near, I pray thee, so I can feel thee, my son, whether thou be of my very son Esau or not. He must have wondered about it. You know, what's happening? That doesn't sound right. So anyway, he came up there and he felt the goat hair. And he said, well, your voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he discerned him not, because his hands were hairy, as his brother's Esau's hands. And so he blessed him. And he said, are you my son Esau? And he said, I am. And lied again and again and again. So anyway, he came near and he kissed him and he smelled him and smelled his raiment and blessed him. And he said, see, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Eternal has blessed. No doubt. Probably smelled like fresh-killed goat skin, and he didn't know what he was smelling. Therefore, God give thee of the dew of heaven, and the fatness of the earth, and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Be lord over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee, and blessed be he that blesses thee. Now, this is a fascinating place in the Bible to me because of the fact that here is a patriarchal blessing that is passed on orally, and God, as we will see, and we won't get to it today, but we'll have to go, and you can read it next time if you'd like to, because there's sort of an argument from people who tend to say, now look, God wasn't fair. Why did God let them, through subterfuge, steal away poor old Esau's blessing? How come Jacob got it? And Paul explains it in the 9th chapter of Romans, where he shows that it was of God's intent, and he even has passing reference to Pharaoh, to raise up a vessel to honor or dishonor, that his great name should eventually be known, that his great glory in the long run could be shown to masses of people. And they will ask, well, you know,
Is that right? Is that fair of God to do that? And he said, what will you say to him that lifts up the saw or the axe? You know, what dost thou? And God is using us like human instruments. And Paul goes through that in Romans 9 to show that even prior to the birth of the children, where the one had hold of the heel of the other, that God had predetermined, because of the nature of the two children being born in the womb, which one was in which position, therefore which one would be born first and would be minutes older than the other one, and that the elder shall serve the younger. You'll recall from last week, was made as a prophecy before the two babies were born. And the Apostle Paul explains that. Now here, God allows, just like he allowed the birth of some races of people through incest, that God allowed human beings to do purely earthy human things, dishonest things, and all sorts of subterfuge, and yet God allows that to work out a portion of his plan. So we'll have to get to that next time, and I'll have to break off there in the middle of this because we're going to need these 10 minutes for a little break, and then we'll come back for the sermon promptly at 3 o'clock.